The book of Job is where we find ourselves tonight, as on these Sunday nights we continue to head through the scriptures from Genesis to Revelation, and we come now to a new section of the Old Testament. The Old Testament is broken up really into five different parts. It's made up of the first five books of the Bible, known as the Law, and then followed by the historical books, which we have looked at from Joshua so many months ago. I don't know how many months or years or whatever since we were there. And then all the way through the book of Esther. And then following the book of Esther begins a section of the Bible known as the poetic books, or the books of poetry. And they are really Hebrew poetry. Begins with the book of Job, then on into Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. And then after that, there is the division of the major prophets and then the minor prophets. And then we head into the New Testament. But tonight, we begin an entirely new section of the Old Testament with the book of Job, with the books of poetry. The book of Job is believed to be next to the first 11 chapters of Genesis to be the oldest record in the Bible. Job is considered by the experts, as you look at the genealogies and the names of the cities and all that are located in Genesis, he was probably a contemporary of Abraham, maybe even a little bit older than Abraham. And so it gives you a place for the setting. One of the reasons that this is important as we get into the book is you're going to see that here is a very righteous man who is mightily stricken by the enemy due to no sin in his life. And he is, his wealth is stricken, his health is stricken. And then there's the idea concerning that well, you know, the whole question is brought in as it relates to covenants. That happened because he was under an Old Testament covenant, but he wasn't. The book of Job predates the covenants of the Old Testament, except for the covenant, you know, made with Noah, predates the covenant probably made with Abraham and then later on with Moses. The books of the Bible that are known as the poetic books are books that are favorites among us as God's people. They're the books that we find ourselves going to when we're in deep water, when we're in deep trouble, when we're in difficult trials. We find ourselves in the book of Job, don't we? We find ourselves in the Psalms, don't we? We find ourselves in Ecclesiastes and Proverbs and the Song of Solomon. We find ourselves there. We find ourselves even drawn to that section of the Bible, sometimes not even knowing why. And one of the reasons that it appeals to us so much is that this section of the Bible is so experiential. It's not like the book of Romans that's a treatise on salvation. And that first eight chapters, so intellectual, necessary, important, that our faith be intellectual. But there are times in our walk where we don't want to read something purely intellectual, though that touches our heart, mind, and soul in strength also. But we want to go someplace where we feel like whoever it is that's in the middle of this feels what we feel. So it's very, very experiential. The book, these poetic books, they also deal with individuals more than with nations. And we can relate to individuals going through things more than we can relate to whole nations going through things as it relates to application in our life. And they very much deal with the human heart. And so we see even in the title of this book, the book of Job, that it deals with a man. It's the story of a man. And you tell me that and immediately I'm with you. You tell me it's the story of a nation, I'm still with you. It's just going to be a little harder on me, and you better be good at seeing how, telling me how it all fits for me in terms of application. You tell me that this is a man, a godly man, a man trying to be a witness for the Lord in his day and in his hour and what he went through in those deep waters. And now you've got me, and you've got me easily as it relates to my attention. The theme of the book is really the mystery of suffering among the godly. I mean, how do we reconcile the suffering? We can understand the suffering in the world. We can understand the suffering that occurs among the wicked, those who were rebellious against God. But how do we explain the suffering that we as God's people go through when we know that He is sovereign? When we know that He is almighty? That with just one word out of His mouth, everything can change. And so we struggle with that. We struggle with those themes as it relates to our lives when we're in deep, deep trouble. And behind all of the suffering of Job, one of the great lessons that we see here is that there's a very high purpose of God. One of the things that the book of Job does for me, we're going to get into it in just a minute, but one of the things that it does for me is it helps me realize that the most important thing in life and the most important thing concerning my life is not my comfort. It is not my happiness. It makes me realize the great context that I live my life in. And the context that I live my life in is far bigger than just Modesto, bless the Lord. But I mean, a lot bigger than just who's around me in work, at work, just who's around me in my household, even what's around me in this world. The great thing that is being played out, the thing that's important, is what's being played out eternally concerning this world and how it impacts the eternal realm, the spiritual realm, the realm that we so easily lose sight of. That's the most important thing, that my life be a part of that larger canvas, that larger work that is happening, that unseen realm, that realm of what is taking place in the heavenly scene all of the time. The book teaches us that godliness doesn't mean that we're not going to suffer. I'll tell you, we're going to suffer, and as God's children in this world, because this is not home yet for us. We're behind enemy lines, and one of the fascinating things that we also learn from Job, I'm going to tell you the whole thing and then I'll have to repeat it all when we get to it. But one of the fascinating things about Job, and we learn from Job, is that we're not only in a battlefield, we are the battlefield. Do you think Satan is after countries? Do you think he cares one whit about borders? Do you think he cares about governments? Do you think he cares about that? He cares about human beings, souls. And so the battle that is waged in this world is waged concerning the eternal souls of human beings. And so that means for us as his children that we're going to even become the battlefield at times. I'll tell you, it feels like that at times, doesn't it? In our walk with the Lord. Isn't something, you know, we just don't hear the bombs bursting in air in some distant place. They seem to be bursting right inside of our own hearts. One of the great themes of the book also, the word that's repeated over and over in terms of the name of the Lord in the book of Job, is the name the Almighty. It's repeated 31 times in the book. The Lord is revealed 31 times as the Almighty, that He's the Sovereign One. He's the Sovereign. He is the Almighty One. There are two verses in the New Testament that have always troubled me a little bit, and I haven't quite sealed them up in my mind, so maybe I'm foolish for bringing them forward, my unresolved questions. But Paul, writing to the Thessalonians, inspired by the Spirit, wrote and said, "In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you." And so he tells us, in everything, give thanks. I understand that verse. I understand that. That in everything, no matter how bad things are, no matter how terrible things are, that in that circumstance and in that situation, as something to be thankful for. But there's a verse that has always troubled me, and it's in the book of Ephesians. I'll read it to you, Ephesians 5:20. And God writes to the church at Ephesus there, and he says, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Well, I understand the commentaries when they come forth and they say, well, we really can't give thanks for all things. Can we give thanks for the devil? We give thanks for the fall of man. And so I understand all of that. But I wonder at the same time, as I've struggled with that verse as it relates to my life, if there isn't a higher level of spirituality that we cop out on as it relates to interpreting that in that way. I know that that verse has to have some boundaries. But I think that many times the reason that we can't give thanks to God for all things in our life is a failure, really, as it relates to faith and seeing Him as big as He is and as in control as He is of different things. I think that so often, you know, I'm in the middle of trials or in the middle of warfare, some circumstance, and, you know, I'm sitting in there saying, well, you know, Lord, I can give thanks in this, but there's no way I can give thanks for this. No way. Never. Never. You'll never convince me that I could ever give thanks for this. Then you get out of it. A week later, 2 months later, 2 years later, you look back and you say, Lord, if I'd have had enough faith, if I'd have seen it as clearly as I ought to have, I'd have seen that I could have given thanks for all things, even in the middle of that. And so often it's just because in the middle of the trials, we see the picture so small. The picture is so much bigger. This book is given to encourage us in trials, to give us needed perspective in the middle of trials, because the first thing we lose in trials is perspective. It's the first thing I lose. Loss of perspective. I have to run to the Bible to regain perspective because I lose it so quickly. How much comfort this book has given to God's people over the years. What God has produced through this book. And you look at Job, and we're just about to head into it. But you look at Job, and in the middle of that trial, for the 6 months or so that he was in it, in its deepest part, he could have never, this could not be worth, nothing could be worth what he was going through. And yet, there was a great battle being waged in heaven as it relates to him. And then there was going to be him as a source of comfort to God's people all the way through this age and on into the next age, because heaven and earth is going to pass away, but God's word is never going to pass away. So beginning in chapter 1, verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz, and that's believed to be in the area of northern Arabia somewhere, whose name was Job. And that man was blameless, and he was upright, one who feared God and shunned evil and lacked faith. That's not what it says, does it? It says four things about him. He was blameless, no hypocrisy in his life. Nobody could come against him and say, this guy says one thing, but his life is a different thing. Nobody could bring blame against him. He was blameless. He was upright, that means he was straight, things of the Lord. And he feared the Lord, he had an awesome reverence for the Lord. And as a result of that, he shunned evil, he turned away from evil. So we're introduced to Job, and we learn a little bit about his character. Now we learn about his family. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Blessed, a big family in those days, that was considered a blessing. 10 children today, you feel like Ma and Pa Kettle, but, you know. People, not too many people have 10 kids anymore. And I don't know that, you know, whatever as it relates to that. But in that day and in that culture, have a big family, that was in your mind, that was a sign of being blessed by the Lord, a fruitful womb. And also his possessions were 7,000 sheep. Now, if you had 2 sheep, you were a rich man. Now, in those days, they didn't have bank accounts like we do. You know, you got your IRAs and you got your T-bills and all this stuff. Your wealth was in material possessions. And so you get an idea. This guy had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels. If you had one of those, that's like a vet. I mean, you were set. 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. So that this man was the greatest of all of the people of the East. And so here he is, the greatest in terms of family, in terms of material possessions. And yet, in just a few moments, he's going to lose it all in one second. You and I cannot own enough things to be secure in things. You cannot have a portfolio that is big enough to protect us from life. You can't get a big enough one. But forgive me, you English teachers. You can't get one that's that big. In 24 hours, it can be gone. In that age and in this age, vaporize. And that's why God works so hard to keep us in a place that our security and our source of peace is in Him. So that if something is touched or it is moved, we won't be moved with it. And so you're looking and say, surely this guy, you know, could have said, well, I'm going to tear down these barns, build bigger barns. I mean, this guy was set to the end of his life, and yet, hey, nothing can provide security apart from a relationship with the Lord. Now his sons would go out, verse 4, and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, probably their birthdays. And they would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. So that was nice of them. And so it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning, and he would offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it might be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. And thus Job did regularly. Now, it wasn't that they were at these birthday parties sinning. Here's just a father that is an interceding father. And so he's got that role as the head of the household, and he's covering his kids with his prayers and with his sacrifices, his intercession for them. And so a very spiritual man, a man who had spiritual leadership of his household. And this he did regularly. Now there was a day when the sons of God, probably a reference to angels, they came to present themselves before the Lord, probably in the heavenly scene. And Satan also came among them. Now, we notice that Satan has access to heaven. And he still has access to heaven. We're told that he's not going to be cast out as the accuser of the brethren until the middle of the tribulation period. Then he's going to be cast out, the one, we're told in Revelation 12, who accused, the accuser of the brethren, who accused them before our God day and night. He's been cast down. So Satan is going to be cast down at that time. But now he has access to the heavenly scene, and what does he do when he's up there? He brings accusation against you and me. That's what he does. Now imagine that he would have something to accuse us of. But he does. And he regularly accuses us. You remember when Simon Peter, he's never gonna deny the Lord and everything, and Jesus finally said to him, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he might sift, you know, you as wheat. He asked for me by name? He's got my Social Security. He asked for me by name? It's a heavy thing. Satan learns your name. But Jesus said, but I've prayed for you that your faith should not fail. You'll fail. But your faith won't fail. And when you've returned to me, strengthen your brethren. And so he asks for us. And if you have the character of a Job, if we're going to live contrary to the mores of this world, we're going to gain the devil's attention just the way that it is. He's going to notice us just the way that he noticed Job. So he comes in before the Lord, and the Lord said to Satan, where do you come from? What you been doing? Like he didn't know. And Satan answered the Lord and said, well, from going to and fro on the earth, from walking back and forth on it. So that's what he does. He just hangs out and kind of walks back and forth and finding something to accuse the brethren of, and then heads up to accuse them. Now, it's fascinating to me that, you know, Peter takes the same imagery when he talks about the fact that Satan walks about as a roaring lion. Probably takes it from the book of Job, seeking whom he might devour. So that's that idea that he's walking around. Notice that Satan can really only be one place at a time. He's not everywhere all at once. I think that's important to understand about Satan. Now, Satan is more powerful than you and I individually apart from the Lord. He's nothing compared to our Lord. That's the comparing the finite with the infinite. And that means, you know, you're a cigarette butt in an ashtray. You're nothing. Just nothing. The finite cannot be compared to the infinite. And he is finite. He can only be one place at one time, even when he's strolling on the earth. So sometimes, you know, a person will say, boy, the devil's really attacking me. You know, well, you know, maybe. But, you know, he might be more involved with Billy Graham. I don't know. If he's going to be one place at one time, probably just a demonic realm that's attacking us. So he comes forth. He's been walking to and fro on the earth. And then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? And now here's God's assessment. A blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. And I like this because God gets to kind of brag about Job a little bit, kind of gets to pull the picture out of his wallet before the devil. And it's nice for a dad to have a few of those, to be able to do that with. And he's obviously, his heart is blessed by Job, and that's his assessment. And notice what Satan does. So Satan answered the Lord, and he says, does Job fear God for nothing? You made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side. Oh. How did you discover that, Satan? Because I tried to attack him on every side and discovered a hedge there. Tried to attack him first personally, and then attack him through his friends, and attack him around his household and all. And all I ran into is this wall that you put around him. And you've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. And so here he says, yeah, I've noticed him, and I've attacked him. Not just noticed him, but attacked him. And so here we see now this larger context that we live our lives in, this eternal context of how God sees it and this work of the enemy. And then Satan gives his accusation concerning the devil, and he says, now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And so the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, only don't lay a hand on his person. And then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Satan had a simple thing. His accusation was this. Job doesn't love you. The only reason he follows you, the only way that reason he, you know, has this relationship with you is because what you give him. You take away what you give him. You take away the blessings in his life of a physical nature, and you leave him only with the blessing of a personal relationship with you, and he's going to curse you right to your face. That's the accusation of the enemy. Now, he doesn't make it foolishly. He makes it because it's true of a lot of people. How many people, when the material things are taken away, and then what do they? They curse God over that. They're angry with God over that. And what does that reveal? They had a relationship with the blessings of God. Didn't have a relationship with God, or it wasn't very deep. And so here's this accusation. But he figures that everybody is that way. Take away their material blessings, and you know, I mean, you can imagine if somebody comes up to me concerning one of my two daughters and says, you know, well, of course they, you know, hang out with you and they say they love you. I mean, you give them blessings. I mean, take away the food and the shelter and they'll curse you to your face. And what if that was true of our children? I mean, see, he's making an accusation not just against Job, but he's making it against God. You have to buy your friends. You have to buy your children's loyalty. And it's a real slap to the face of God.
And so God said, all right, go ahead and touch what he has. Don't touch his body in order to reveal that Satan was wrong. Now, there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabians raided them, took them away. Indeed, they've killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. So you imagine that news comes to you that all your oxen, all your donkeys have been, you know, taken away and your servants killed. And while he was still speaking, the first messenger, another messenger also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven. No, it wasn't. It was from Satan. And burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And then while that second messenger is speaking, the words still echoing in his ears, then another came and said, the Chaldeans formed three bands, raided the camels, took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And you say, oh man, nothing could be worse than that. And then another messenger came up and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness, struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young men, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you. In 1 second, he loses all of his possessions, and he loses all 10 of his children. Now, some of you in this room have lost children. You almost have to take a while to camp at this place in the Bible to begin to get a feel for the level of trial that has hit him in just 1 second. And they talk about being punched in the stomach, you know, with bad news that leaves you reeling, gasping for air. I don't know what this must have felt like to Job. You know, very difficult trial that came to him, you know, so powerfully and so strongly. It's interesting that Satan really lives up to his name of destroyer, doesn't he? Really lives up to that name of destroyer. He did everything right up to the limit of what the Father allowed him to do. Did not one quarter of an inch back from it. He did everything that he could do. He's a destroyer. When people sit in this world, people have no idea the blessings that are a part of the life of the believer and the unbeliever alike because of the restraint that God has placed on the devil and the carnage that this world would be if Satan had free reign. Is there a human being on the face of this planet at this moment that is listening to music and enjoying it? They do it because Satan is bound. Is there a person tonight on the face of this planet who reads a book and gets joy out of it? They do it because Satan is bound. Otherwise, the entire planet would be a carnage. And so he takes and he lives up to his name. And notice the response of Job here. He arose, verse 20, and then he tore his robe, the sign of mourning, shaved his head also, a sign of mourning, and then he fell to the ground and he worshiped. So he mourned, and just as any of us would mourn at the loss of our children, and then he falls to the ground and he worships. His relationship with the Lord greater than everything else. It was a refuge for me. Turn to that. And then notice what he declares in verse 21. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb. I didn't bring anything into this world. And naked I'm going to return there. I'm going to go back to the earth and I'm not going to take anything with me. Didn't bring anything in. Not going to bring anything out. He said, the Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Repeats the Lord's name 3 times. Just these couple of short sentences. He recognized that all that he had was from the Lord. Interesting, isn't it? Satan completely misread this guy. He thought this guy would curse God. He doesn't. He blessed the Lord. He blessed the Lord. All that stuff that he had, Satan thought he, you know, was just, you know, using, just walking with God because he had those things. The whole time, he saw all of that as a stewardship. And Job, we're going to see a little bit later, was a great giver to the poor. He never viewed all of those resources as his. Even the children, he viewed them as a stewardship given from the Lord. And so the Lord's, it was his to begin with. He's free to do it with it, whatever he wants to do. And I bless his name. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all of this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. These few verses, 21 and 22, have been a huge comfort to God's people through the ages. If you go through very, very old cemeteries, whether in Europe and or in the United States, in countries where there's a strong Christian heritage, it's not unusual to go through and find a tombstone that will say, "The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord." And then when you look at the dates on that tombstone, you find out that it was, 1901 to 1903. A child died. And then where did the parents go for comfort and perspective? They went to Job right here at the end of chapter 1. And they said concerning their own children, "The Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord." And so his relationship with the Lord was bigger than just, the possessions. And I think that Job, when you look at what he says here in verse 21, he never was grander in all of his life than when he sits right there with nothing and he praises the Lord in the middle of that. I'm in awe of this man. I really am. Really am. Say, "Oh, look at all the wealth and look at all the things and all." And say, "Oh, man, no, you couldn't gain any more respect for him." Yes, you can. When a man can respond to the things like this in the Lord the way that he did. Chapter 2. "And again there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came along to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, where are you coming from? And so Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro from the earth and from walking back and forth on it. And then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. And so Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life." All right? Yeah, he didn't curse you because of the taking of the possessions, but if you touch his body, he'll curse you. And again, he's a mercenary. He follows you as long as you provide him with health. But if his health goes, he'll curse you, God. And so he said, "Stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he'll surely curse you to your face." And so the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he's in your hand, but spare his life. You can do everything but kill him." And that's exactly what Satan is going to do. And Satan went out from the presence of the Lord, and he struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Ever had a boil? Don't shout out. Ever had a boil? That is painful. Can you imagine from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, one solid boil? How do you get comfortable? There's no position of comfort in that condition. Excruciatingly painful. And notice in verse 8 that he took for himself a broken piece of pottery, a potsherd with which to scrape himself while he sat in the midst of the ashes. And so we don't know, maybe he's down by the dump now where they burn the things in the area that he's in. Or maybe there's just the oozing of the boils and he's got the ashes on him, to try and dry the thing. And then, the only ease is just to kind of scrape himself with the potsherd. I mean, just overnight, the most powerful man in that part of the world. And then now here he is in this condition, absolutely unrecognizable, to provide you and I with comfort, to provide you and I with perspective. hope in the middle of trial, in the middle of difficulty. And then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die." Well, that's a perky little wife for you, isn't it? But she's also lost 10 children. And her husband is in the worst pain she's ever seen him in, in his whole life. And what she's saying is, go ahead and curse God so that he'll strike you dead and your pain and my pain will be over. Now you can understand it in the natural, but it's bad counsel. It's bad counsel. She's encouraging him to turn from his integrity when he needed encouragement in his integrity with the Lord. This guy needed some encouragement at this particular point in time. And so she's just saying, I'd rather see you dead than to see you suffering. But wrong counsel, because she's calling on him to abandon his faith. And notice what he does. Is that, you know, not only am I in this trial, but now I've got to rebuke you. He says to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity? And in all of these things, Job did not sin with his lips." Amazing man. Now, when Job's three friends heard of all of his adversity that had come upon him, each one came from his own place. They heard about his problems. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. For they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with Job and to comfort him. That's what they came. Their idea was to come and encourage him and to mourn with him and to comfort him. That was the idea at the beginning. They're not going to be much of any of that to him, but that's what they planned on being. And when they raised their eyes from afar and they didn't recognize him, he's unrecognizable, and they lifted up their voices and wept. Now, you put yourself in Job's place, and your three friends come, and they see you from about 300 yards away. Is that Job? It's Job. It can't be Job. Job. And all of a sudden, they begin to cry as they're coming to see you. I don't know about you, but I think that would be comforting. And Job has to feel, all right, some compassion. These guys are going to take care of me. They're going to comfort me. They're going to help me. Somebody understands. And so here they come. They lifted up their voices and they wept, and each one of them tore their robe. They sprinkled dust on their head towards heaven, signs of mourning. They sat down with him on the ground. 7 days and 7 nights they sat with Job. Nobody said a word to him, for they saw that his grief was very great. Nobody wanted to say anything. He was going to have to break the silence. And so they come to him. Now, they would have done well if the 7 days had turned into 7 or 6 months of silence. But they're going to begin to speak about things that they don't understand. His friends are going to take a hit because they were miserable comforters. But I'll tell you something. There's something commendable about them, and that is they came to Job. And they came to him, and what they did have to say, they said to his face. That was more than a lot of people were doing about Job in those days. They at least came and said it to his face. And they were dead wrong, but at least they were man enough to do that. Chapter 3. And after this 7 days, Job opened his mouth, and he cursed the day that he was born. So you can imagine. Here Job understands what has happened to him, but he doesn't understand why it's happened to him. And he spoke and he said, "May the day perish in which I was born." He said, "I wish I wasn't born." "And the night in which it was said, a male child was conceived." I curse the day I was conceived. "May that day be darkness, and may God above not seek it, nor the light shine upon it. May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that day, may darkness seize it, and May it not be included among the days of the year. May it not come into the number of the months. Oh, may that night be barren, no conception. May no joyful shout come into it. May those curse it who curse the day, those who are ready to arouse Leviathan, may the stars of its morning be dark, and may it look for light but have none, and not see the dawning of the day, because it did not shut up the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide sorrow from my eyes. Why didn't I die at birth? Why didn't I perish when I came from the womb? Why wasn't I stillborn? Now, this isn't a guy waxing eloquent. He feels this. Why was I even born? Why did I have to be born to this? Why was I conceived? Why wasn't I stillborn? That's the depth of the trial that he's in. Sometimes we find ourselves in that place. Why did the knees receive me at that birth? Or why the breasts that I should nurse? For now I would have lain still and been quiet. I would have been asleep. I wouldn't be going through this if I had been stillborn. And then I would have been at rest with kings and the counselors of the earth who built ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. I'd be dead with them. Or why was I not hidden like a stillborn child? In other words, not seeing the light of day, like infants who never saw the light. There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest, and there the prisoners rest together. They do not hear the voice of the oppressor. The small and the great are there, and the servant is free from his master. Why is light given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter of soul who long for death, but it does not come, and search for it more than hidden treasures? I'll tell you something. Good thing one of his friends wasn't Dr. Kevorkian. Serious side, though. Serious. The people that are being taken out in this way, you think they're in a deeper trial than Job is in? You see, I mean, it's just, you know, heavy what's happening all around us. There can be times where we hit these feelings in our life. And what's needed is godly perspective and not someone coming along and making an easy way out in what looks the easiest. And he said, those who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they can find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden and whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes before I eat, and my groanings pour out like water. For the thing I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me, and I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest for trouble that comes. So he asks the question over and over again in this section. Why? Why? Why, why, why? The problem is that when we're in these kinds of trials and we're asking why, if God reveals the reason why, then the trial is lost. It ceases to be something that builds faith and godly character in my life. And one of the hardest things we deal with in life is not just the trials that we find ourselves in as God's people, but then when God is silent in those trials. That's the hardest. But many times if he speaks up and reveals the reason why, then the advantage of the trial's lost. The reason is saved for an appointed time. So he cries out, and it's interesting in verse 25, the thing that I greatly feared has come upon me, and what I dreaded has happened to me. I remember watching a faith teacher on television teach from that particular passage, and he was railing on the faith of Job, that all of this came into his life because of a lack of faith. I don't know how he should have read the first three chapters here to understand the big picture, but it was his lack of faith in all of this. And I just, you know, took and changed the channel and didn't know what to do with it in my heart, because to me, Job is one of the mountaintops in the Bible. and to imagine that I would, degrade his faith and say it was his lack of faith that caused all of this to come into his life. Well, Job has spoken these words concerning his trial, and then Eliphaz, probably the oldest of the comforters, decides that he's going to make an attempt now to comfort Job. Then Eliphaz, chapter 4, verse 1, the Temanite answered and said, "If one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking?" So insensitive. He waits 7 days to say something, and then the guy says, in effect, can somebody else get a word in here edgewise? The guy's just lifted up in the pain that he's in. And he said, "Surely you have instructed many. You've strengthened weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling. You, Job, have strengthened the feeble knees. But now when it comes upon you, you're weary. It touches you and you're troubled. Is not your reverence, your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?" In other words, Job, you could dish it out, couldn't you? When people were in their trial and their difficulties and you pointed them to God, you could do it then, couldn't you? But now, when you're in that place, now you can't take it. I think I'd buy this guy an airline ticket home. One of the things that happens in our handling of the Word of God is that we better teach the Word and we better preach the Word beyond our experience. We better do that. And just because you and I haven't been in the place of Job, perhaps, in that degree, doesn't mean that we can't declare the Word of God with all of the authority that is worthy of that Word, because it stands and it stands. It doesn't stand and fall. It stands and it stands because it's the Word of God. Not just because it's proven itself true in my life. There may be degrees of trials that some of us never experience, but we can preach the truth of God related to those trials, the provision of God, the ability of God. And we need to do that. I'll tell you concerning my life. I experience trials like everyone else. I don't know where they are on the scale, but I preach and point people to God, whether in this kind of an assembly or individually or whatever. And I'll tell you, on the day that I hit a trial, like Job, or a trial that's bigger than I've experienced before, what I will expect from you is the Word of God. Not what you've experienced, but that perspective. And so we preach beyond our experience, knowing that, hey, when we hit that trial, there are a lot of times where I talk with someone and they're in a trial that's unbelievable. And I shudder at the size of it, the magnitude of it. But the Word has to be given with that understanding that if I find myself in their place, that someone needs to give me the Word also. If I'm ever in Job's place, I'm ever on my deathbed someplace, I want somebody to come and tell me the Word of God. Say, "Pastor, you remember when you spoke about death being a butler, being an usher? You spoke about these different things and the victory that's there in Jesus. And now you're in this place. Let me remind you of what we've heard from God's Word," but not in a mocking way. And so he's just making, just terrible. It's like, yeah, you could say it to people in need, but then when you got in that trial, now you don't believe what you said. No, I just needed a little encouragement at the time. Thank you. And so, verse 7, Eliphaz continues and says, "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright ever cut off?" Job, you're in the condition that you're in because you're not innocent. You're not upright. There's sin in your life. Now you tell this to a man that's lost his 10 children and everything he owns, and he's covered from head to toe with boils. And now you tell him,
that it's because of sin in his life. But what was God's assessment of him? He's blameless, upright, nothing wrong with him, no sin in his life. But that's going to be the theme of all these comforters, is that the reason that you're in the difficulty that you're in is because of sin in your life. Don't you think that Job agonized over that before they ever broached the subject? Don't you find sometimes where you get into a difficult situation, the first thing that sometimes our flesh will bring up is, it must be sin in my life. I must be a terrible Christian. I must be the world's worst, you know, and that kind of, and not necessarily. And you don't need someone to come and remind you, of that, or to bring up a false accusation. It wasn't because of sin in his life. He said in verse 8, even as I have seen those who plow iniquity, you've been plowing iniquity, Job, they sow trouble, and sow trouble they reap the same, and by the blast of God they perish. Your children are dead because of your sin, and by the breath of his anger they are consumed. And the roaring of the lion, the voice of the fierce lion, and the teeth of the young lions are broken, speaking of the death of the children. And the old lion perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. Now a word, he says, this is what he does. He's basing his counsel on experience. I've never seen, in all these situations like this, I've never seen it except it's like this. There's sin in it as a result of it. And so rather than giving him the word, he's giving him, you know, his philosophy based upon experience. And then he shares a vision with Job. And he said, now a word was secretly brought to me, and my ear received a whisper of it. In disquieting thoughts from the visions of the night, when sleep, deep sleep falls on men, fear came upon me and trembling, which made all of my bones shake. And then a spirit passed before my face. The hair on my body stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes. There was silence. And then I heard a voice saying, he's having this vision, can a mortal be more righteous than God? Can a man be more pure than his Maker? And if he puts no trust in his servants, if he charges his angels with error, how much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundation is in the dust, who are crushed before a moth? They are broken in pieces from morning until evening. They perish forever with no one regarding. Does not their own excellence go away? They die even without wisdom. And so now he says it's not only sin in his life, but now he's going to identify the sin through this vision that he's been given here. And the vision is something out of his own heart. This vision didn't come from God. And he's telling Job that the reason that he's in the situation that he's in is because of sin, and he's in it because of the sin of pride. He sees himself as more righteous than God, more pure than his Maker, and he regards his own excellence. False. Job never thought that. He never thought that. We have to be very careful. And I believe in visions and dreams that come from the Lord. But not everything that is declared to be a vision or a dream from the Lord is a vision or dream. Here is a guy who comes with a vision, and it's not of the Lord. It is of his own making and his own heart. I suspect that he, in looking at Job over the years, felt that Job thought he was better than even God. And now when Job finally finds himself in this position of vulnerability, he makes up a vision, doesn't do it on purpose, but something is birthed in his heart that allows him to communicate what he's felt wrongly about Job all of this time. It happens easily when people find themselves in difficult situations. It's amazing what can be said, what people will bring out at that time, the suspicions that they've had, but the suspicions that are so often wrong. He totally misjudged Job completely. And this vision didn't come from the Lord. It came up out of his own mind. He says in chapter 5, call out now. Is there anyone who will answer to you? And to which of the holy ones will you turn? For wrath kills a foolish man, and envy slays a simple one. And I have seen the foolish taking root, but suddenly I cursed his habitation.
and his sons are far from safety. They're crushed in the gate and there's no deliverer. Again, this guy's ruthless. Again, bringing up, your sons are dead because of your sin. It looked good and then it was, destroyed, your habitation because of sin in your life, because the hungry eat up his harvest, taking it even from the thorns. And a snare snatches their substance, for affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble spring from the ground. Yet man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward, and so we are due to sin. But as for me, he says, this is what I would do, Job. I'd seek God, and to God I would commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth, and he sends waters on the fields, and he sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty. Now he's accusing them of being crafty, so that their hands cannot carry out their plans. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the counsel of the cunning comes quickly upon them. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noontime as in the night. But he saves the needy from the sword and from the mouth of the mighty and from their hand. And so the poor have hope, and injustice shuts her mouth. Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Now he's telling him that God's chastening him. This guy is—he's going through the whole Christian counseling book. He's gonna bring everything out in this thing. It's sin in your life. God's chastening you, and your pride, you're proud. You see yourself as better than God. All of this kind of stuff. Listen, this book is instruction, not only to us when we find ourselves in the place of Job, but it is a great book of instruction for when we find ourselves in the place of Job's comforters. And that is, if we don't know what we're talking about, just sit with them. And that's something that some of us learn, harder than others. And, early on in my Christian walk, I felt I had to have an answer for everything. I just had to, here's what's happening here, and some little, snappy comeback to every kind of a deal. You try to get everything all right into place until you come to grips with the fact that God's way bigger than any of our systematic theologies or what we understand about Him. There's no way that the finite can fully understand the infinite. There is no way. And so, the older I get, when I go to the hospital, when I go to the different places, I go and I'm there. That's what I am. I'm there. I don't try to come up with answers. I don't try to come up with visions. How can I help you? What can we do to help you? That's all. And the words have become fewer and fewer and fewer over the years. And certainly no trying to read into every kind of situation. Job didn't need a debate. He didn't need this discussion. He just needed three men to stand by him, encourage him in the things of the Lord, and say, we're here for you. No matter what, we are here for you until we understand what is happening here. If we ever do, that's all he needed. I'll tell you, that's a good friend. That's a good counselor. That's a good counselor. The people that are considered the greatest counselors are the people that never say anything. Somebody comes in, they start to talk, and they talk for the whole hour, and then you never got to say a single word, and you close it up in prayer, and they leave, and they think you are the most awesome counselor on the face of the planet, because they just got to talk, and they kind of discovered the truth for themselves and everything, and you ate your lunch, and kind of deal and all, and the fewer the words, so often, the better. And so here he just feels compelled to have an answer. I got to give this guy some kind of an answer. He can't. He has no answer. Nobody knows right now but heaven what's going on. And that's the position that we find ourselves in continually. So, hey, Job, you're being corrected now. It's God. Happy is the man whom God corrects. Come on, chin up. It's your dauber up, buddy. Happy is the man whom God corrects. Oh. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty, for He bruises, but He binds up. He wounds, but His hands make whole. He shall deliver you in 6 troubles. Yes, in 7, no evil shall touch you. In famine, He shall redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the scourge of the tongue, and you shall not be afraid of destruction when it comes. And you shall laugh at destruction and famine, and you shall not be afraid of the beasts of the earth, for you shall have a covenant with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field shall be at peace with you, and you shall know that your tent is in peace. You shall visit your habitation and find nothing amiss. You shall also know that your descendants shall be many, and your offspring like the grass of the earth. Thank you for bringing that up again. You shall come to the grave at full age, as a sheaf of grain ripens in its season. Behold, this we have searched out. It's true. Hear it and know for yourself. And so this guy knows how to close an argument here, and yet not a single thing that he said was true. And he's just saying, listen, if you just take and receive the chastening of the Lord, then all of these things will turn around. But the Lord wasn't chastening Job. And so at those times, you can just take a deep Jacqueline breath. Inhale, mighty Wurlitzer. Exhale, yes. When we don't know what we're talking about, it's just best not to talk and just to be there. Just to be there, unless we do have God's promises to speak into the situation. And that's what he needed. Again, he didn't need a debate. He needed to be reminded of God's promises. That's all he needed. Job, can I remind you of one promise that God gives His people in this kind of a situation? And you know, it'd be a lot shorter than 2 chapters, and it would have helped Job an awful lot.